uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The only title wrote Louis Brandeis, Supreme Court Justice from 1856, born in 1856, died 1941 as a Supreme Court Justice. Louis Brandeis, the only title he wrote in our democracy, our quote for the day, by the way, superior to that of president is the title of citizen. Citizen. A citizen's America. One of the good old-fashioned liberal ideals of the United States that we, the people, should be running this country, not the corporate elites, not the select few in the corporate media or in the corporate halls of power that wander around in Congress and pass out big bucks. And speaking of passing out big bucks, it is pretty apparent that Tom DeLay is still up to his old tricks. You know, the old tricks that Tom DeLay has been up to for some time now. How long, many people are wondering, how long will he be able to get away with it? Good question. And, the DeLay Political Death Watch, yes. Tom DeLay, still up to his dirty tricks. He thinks the federal treasury is his personal piggy bank. He slipped Progress blog, I believe. He slipped a $1.5 billion giveaway to the oil industry, Halliburton and Sugarland, Texas, into the energy bill. Now, this isn't just your average pork barrel stuff. Normally, let's put $100 million in here for this. Or let's say, No. Because normally, pork barrel stuff, the government administers the money. But Tom DeLay is saying this $1.5 billion, keep in mind, that's like the budget of like the state of Vermont. I mean, that's huge. $1.5 billion? Keep in mind, the entire budget for all cancer research in the United States is $4 billion a year. $1.5 billion. Tom DeLay slipped this in as a giveaway to the oil industry and Halliburton, and it will be privately administered. This from a letter, privately administered by a private consortium that just happens to be located in Tom DeLay's district. If this guy isn't the most corrupt politician in the history of politics, he has to be among the top 10. I mean, you want to have a contest. Henry Waxman outed him on this and wrote a letter to Denny Hastert, the Speaker of the House, saying, please do something about this, essentially. And Waxman points out, quoting from Henry Waxman, the provision was inserted into the energy legislation after the conference was closed. Now, the conference is when the House and the Senate get together and they work things out. And they put the bill into its final form so that it can be voted on by the House and Senate, and it's the same bill that everybody's voting on. So once the vote is over, the president can just sign it. Okay? In other words, the House works on a bill, the Senate works on a bill. There are differences between the two. They go to conference. The conference works out the differences. So now you have one clean bill that all says the same thing. Then it goes back to the House and Senate where they both vote on it. But now they're voting on an identical bill, and then the president signs it. That's how it works. So after conference, there is no possibility for the House or the Senate to change a piece of legislation because then it would have to go through the whole process all over again. And so they just don't do it. So here, Henry Waxman, the provision was inserted into the energy legislation after the conference was closed, so members of the conference committee had no opportunity to consider or reject this measure. The subtitle appears to steer the administration of 75% of the $1.5 billion fund to a private consortium located in the district of Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Ordinarily, a large fund like this would be administered directly by the government. End of quote from Henry Waxman. $1.5 billion. Now, my recollection may be wrong, but I don't think so. My recollection is that the total amount spent on all human welfare in the United States is around $16 or $17 billion a year. So this has got to be more than all of Ronald Reagan's notorious welfare queens in the state of Texas combined make. Why isn't anybody complaining about Tom DeLay's welfare bill for his rich friends? Why aren't the Republicans complaining about it? Why aren't the cons complaining? Where are the right-wing bloviators? Where are the talk show hosts? Where is Robert Novak? And why isn't he in jail? Yeah, well, I'd say Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay better get their act together. I mean, DeLay has stacked the Ethics Committee. You got good old Doc Hastings of the state of Washington on there and go along with whatever he says, Doc. And we'll see. Rick Santorum in the news, he's saying it takes a family to raise children, not a village. You'll recall yesterday I mentioned that one of the big differences between conservatives and liberals in terms of their perspective of morality is the conservatives are concerned about what goes on behind closed doors in your bedroom. And liberals are concerned about what goes on out in open with the world. Now, obviously, both have some concern. There's some crossover. But the main thing is that conservative morality is who's having sex with whom. And liberal morality is, are there hungry people among us? Are there poor people among us? Are there, naked people among us? Are there, clothing, people lacking the necessities? I use the phrase from Matthew 25. Jesus talks about, clothing the naked. Are there homeless among us? Are there those who are imprisoned inappropriately? In other words, is there social justice? And in this book, Rick Santorum is basically taking on that concept and saying, no, it's not about social justice. It all has to, it's all up to the family. And then he has the audacity to say, the problem with America is working women. That, women are working in the workplace, and so, their kids are coming home to an empty house. Now, that's a very real problem. Why are they working? Ask Rick Santorum. Well, he says they're working so that they can pay the tax bills for their husbands. Because the second wage earner in a family earns generally about 25% of what the main wage earner earns, and that's enough. That's about what the tax load is. He fails to mention that they're actually getting services for those taxes. They're getting education for their children. They're getting fire protection. They're getting police protection. They're getting the protection of the court system. They're getting public roads that they can drive on. Excuse me, Rick. See, his solution is, more tax cuts. And he's going to pitch it as middle-class tax cuts, of course, as the cons always do. But it'll be tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, and the middle class will get screwed, as they always do under Republicans. Ronald Reagan presided over the biggest tax increase in the history of the United States, bar none. And 100% of that tax increase that Ronald Reagan presided over hit people earning $30,000 a year or less. And what did he do with that money? He passed another tax cut for people making over $1 million or more. It's the conservative way. But anyhow, what Rick Santorum doesn't point out is that the reason why second members of families, traditionally wives, but increasingly husbands, are having to take a second job, or the significant others, in unconventional families, having to take a second job or a third job or a fourth job, is because cons like Rick Santorum have declared war on working people in America. They've destroyed our economy. They've ruined the nation. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. So, anyhow, in fact, Bob in Boston, he sends a note about this. And here's a letter from Sister Liguri Rosner, Sisters for Christian Community in Bloomfield. She's a teacher of the Diocese of Pittsburgh for 14 years. One important lesson I learned was that no matter what I said to the child, whatever the parents said superseded my message. She said, Rick Santorum and his wife have taught their children a powerful lesson in civic responsibility by refusing to pay any tuition money to the Penn Hills School District for their children who attended the Pennsylvania Cyber Charter School. Released from that payment on a technicality shows that even an upstanding moral gentleman like Senator Santorum teaches his children the following lessons. 1. Take advantage of the system whenever you can. 2. The little guy pays while the rich and powerful guy gets away with it. And 3. As a Catholic, you have no obligation to pay your share to the common good in spite of Catholic social doctrine. Sister Rosner says, finally, I'm shocked that our religious leaders who see Senator Santorum as some sort of faith and morals hero have not spoken up on this issue. So, interesting stuff. But the big story of the day, the big story, the lead story, of course, the House of Representatives last night passed CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. But what's interesting about this is that there seem to be a couple of missing votes. I noticed this morning that if you add up the number of votes on this CAFTA bill, that, you know, if one Democrat, there were 15 Democrats who voted in favor of it, the traitor, turncoat Democrats who voted in favor of it, 15 of them, if one of them had voted against it, it would have lost. But interestingly, Joanne Davis of Virginia and Charles Taylor of North Carolina, a couple of Republicans, were listed as not having voted. We called Charles Taylor's office, and they told us that he actually voted against it. And there must have been some glitch because Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay didn't record his no vote. Keep an eye on this, folks. There may be an unfolding scandal here. In the meantime, the 15 Democratic sellouts. If one of these folks is your member of Congress, I encourage you to call them at 1-877-SOB-USOB and give them a piece of your mind. Tell them exactly what you think of them. These are the Democrats who voted in favor of CAFTA. We've got to start holding these people accountable. Melissa Bean of Illinois. Jim Cooper of Tennessee. Henry, I believe it's Cuellar, of Texas. Norm Dix of Washington State. Ruben Hinosa of Texas. William Jefferson of Louisiana, Jim Matheson of Utah, Greg Meeks of New York, Dennis Moore of Kansas, Jim Moran of Virginia, Solomon Ortiz of Texas, Ike Skelton of Missouri, Vic Snyder of Arkansas, John Tanner of Tennessee, and Ed Towns of New York. Now, 9 of these guys even went so far as to also vote for the bankruptcy bill. For the bankruptcy bill. And they need to be held to account also. That's those 9 are Bean, Cooper, Sealer, Hinosa, Matheson, Meeks, Moore, Moran, and Tanner. You can give these guys a call. If one of them represents you, give them a call at 1-877-SOB-USOB. Yes, that's the toll-free number for Congress. It's the old Senate Office Building phone number, thus SOB, Senate Office Building. 1-877-SOB-USOB, and let them know what you think and what you're going to do. And I suggest, frankly, if they've got a Democrat running against them in the primary, because all of these guys are up for re-election, men and women are up for re-election next year, if there's a Democrat running for them, against them in the primary, support that other person. We've just got to say enough. Enough. We're tired of the Democratic Party being sold out by folks like the DLC. More about that and Hillary Clinton, what she's up to after this. Plus your calls. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Indian workers with tech support skills work more cheap and speak English just fine. It's a jobless recovery. Why pay a salary? We can outsource all the work that we need. It's a
welcome back, my friends. Yes, George Bush, the second president since Herbert Hoover, actually the first president since Herbert Hoover, the second president in the last 100 years, to have not created one single new private sector job in his entire presidency. He's still 20,000 jobs in the hole. a jobless recovery, at the very least. By the way, in the second hour of our program, we're going to have a conservative on who's going to tell us that the poor should be allowed to sell their body parts to the rich, that there should be no laws against it, it shouldn't be regulated, if your family is hungry and you can't afford to pay them, even if it means you die, sell your heart, sell your liver, sell your kidneys, whatever, there should be an open market in body organs. And in the third hour of our program, we're going to get into the real privatization scandal, the CIA's covert operations. And we're going to be talking with Joseph J. Trento, who just published a brilliant book, Prelude to Terror. And it's all about how the Bush family, going back to the 1940s, and their relationship with Saudi Arabia, and the October surprise program to blow Jimmy Carter out of the water, and the privatization of the CIA that took place under Bush Sr. when he was head of the CIA, that all of that led directly to 9/11. And this guy, Joe Trento, is not a conspiracy nut. He wrote one of the most authoritative books on the CIA that's ever been written. And this is just good. This is a good, solid history book, and you're going to find the third hour of the program among the most fascinating today. So anyhow, just as a heads up, in general, 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number if you'd like to call. TomHartmann.com, the URL, the website, and you can drop into our live chat room. Go to TomHartmann.com, however you spell it, and just click live chat. It'll take you there. If it's your first time, hold down the control key when you click register, and a little window will pop up, and you can put in your name and your password and just, you know, pick one. We don't sell people's names. We don't keep track of any of that stuff. It's all, you know, it's just a database that the chat server holds, and your anonymity, privacy will be protected and respected. John in Virginia is on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the Tom Hartmann program.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm sorry, John. It helps if I push the right button here. What's up?
Okay. I really enjoy your show. You know, you were talking about that $1.5 billion.
Yeah, that's going to Tom DeLay's district.
Yes. You know, that would probably make up the shortfall in the VA.
Yeah, it would, actually. That would be enough to give medical benefits to all of our veterans. Yeah, sure enough.
Yeah,
but Tom DeLay doesn't give a damn about that, I can tell you that.
So we see who he supports and the Republican Party supports, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, John, for the comment.
Okay,
it's well said, and it's tragic, but it's true. Dave in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I keep wondering how so many Americans can be so stupid, how they can be kept so misinformed. I do know we have...
Well, they're working themselves to death, number one, and you got a media that is owned by the defense contractors, number two. I mean, GE, MSNBC, NBC, they make nuclear weapons and things. They're making a fortune off the war. And you've got politicians like George Bush who actually threaten to punish people who tell the truth, even within their own administration.
Yeah, and wherever you drive your car, you can get Hannity and Medford and Limbaugh across the country.
Yeah.
All of them, you know, they know that they are there to simply sell a very bad product to the people. They're there to keep us misinformed.
And that's why they have to work so hard at it, because it's a very bad product. The vast majority of Americans don't want the conservative product. They don't want a poorer America, more desperate workers. They don't want, you know, illegal immigrants given immediate amnesty so that we're now competing with them in the job force. They don't want our air dirtier. They don't want our water owned by private corporations. And we're told that, like Bechtel did in Bolivia, that if you're going to collect rainwater, you have to buy a permit from them for it. I mean, you know, the vast majority of Americans are not with the conservative agenda at all.
Well, you and a few wonderful people like yourself are helping to wise us up. I hope you get in every state in the country.
From your lips to God's ears, Dave. Well, actually, we are on Sirius Satellite Radio. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you, and thanks for listening on KGOE. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
It's a hard knock life.
Yeah.
It's a hard knock life.
Stick that in your pipe and smoke it.
It's the Republican vision.
For all my homies in Bruges.
It's a hard knock life. Yes, indeed. Brought to you courtesy of the Republican Party, George W. Bush, and the conservative Democrats, including the traitors among the Democratic Party who just voted for CAFTA. And I hope you will please call 1-877-SOB-USOB and give them hell. And I it's not a word I use on the radio very often. You can tell how upset I am by this. So something to be sharing with, you know, friends, family, and whatnot.
Now, Behind Enemy Lines.
Yes, we give you the right-wing talking points, so you don't have to listen to the right-wing talking points on right-wing radio. Sure enough, I got this in the mail this morning from the RNC, the right-wing talking points for the day. They're going to point out, they're trying to do reverse spin on CAFTA. This is damage control about CAFTA, the fact that it got passed in the middle of the night, that they held the vote open for 80 minutes when it's only supposed to be by law 15 minutes or by House rules 15 minutes. They kept the vote open. And there's even a few missing votes, apparently. We know of one at least so far, that being Charles Taylor of North Carolina, whose office insists that he did vote no, and somehow Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert didn't count that vote. But, you know, whether it actually passed or didn't pass, you know, legally or illegally, the cons control the House and the Senate. They're going to say it passed. And so CAFTA, and it will be signed, of course, by George W. Bush, who just loves the idea of outsourcing jobs, his whole administration. Yes, outsource jobs. They publish books, you know, websites on how companies can outsource jobs. They give tax credits to companies and tax breaks to companies that outsource jobs. The more that they can do to destroy the industrial base of this country, the happier they are. And it's treason. I mean, it's economic treason. Giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States, the economic enemies of the United States, it is economic treason what these guys are doing. So anyhow, they're trying to spin this. So the Republican National Committee this morning sent out the following talking points that went to all the Republican and right-wing talk show hosts. This is what you'll be hearing on Rush Limbaugh's show today. It's about how the Democratic Leadership Council, as if they speak for the Democrats, right? First of all, they're trying to spin it that the DLC speaks for the Democrats, because the DLC is Republican light in the Democratic Party, the Democratic Leadership Council. And the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, within the Democratic Party, they are, in my opinion, the cancer in the body politic of the Democratic Party. And so the Republicans are pointing out that the DLC is in favor of CAFTA, which is true. But they're doing it as, you know, they're saying that the Democratic leadership, therefore, is in favor, you know, implying that the Democrats are in favor of passing CAFTA. So why would some Democrats vote against it, right? So, in other words, here's a quote. The DLC gave four reasons to support the trade pact. First, the United States needs to open new markets and increase exports. Yeah, right. The 44 million people of Central America, who on average earn $2 a day, are just so anxious to buy the few remaining little fragments of stuff that we manufacture in the United States, that we really, really, really need to ask them to lower their tariffs so that we can sell our stuff to them. You know, their combined purchasing power is equal to that of the city of New London, Connecticut. But it's 44 million people who are willing to work for $2 a day. Now, that gets the interest of Intel. That gets Nike going. And you don't have to pay for shipping all the way from China or from Asia all the way across the Pacific to get the stuff here. Ooh, now it's starting to look pretty good to the multinational corporations. Secondly, the Republicans quote the DLC as saying, the United States has a tangible political and moral stake in our partners' success. That's true. We really do want nations in this hemisphere to be democratic. Do we do that by letting our multinational corporations take them over? It doesn't seem to have worked so well in a lot of other places. Mexico, for example, as a result of NAFTA, is experiencing greater poverty, drug crime, internal terrorism, like they never had before. Third, the Republicans, quoting the Republican talking points for talk show hosts today, quoting the DLC, Democratic support for, as if it's the Democrats, right, supporting, or even at least an open attitude towards CAFTA can and should be used as leverage to make the agreement better. Right. In other words, we've got this thing, it's not the best in the world, but if you go along with it, you'll actually be able to improve it. Isn't that nice? It's sort of a variation on, she really enjoyed being raped. The forests really enjoy, well, I can't come up with a metaphor that's even tasteful, so I'm not going to try. Fourth, the United States has strategic interests at stake that go beyond exports and beyond the partners themselves. In other words, we have to do this so that we can get our multinational corporations in these countries so that that's somehow magically going to, you know, meet our national security interests, right? And then they go on to say, but several House, Senate and House DLCers, including those who addressed a group this week, voted against CAFTA. Senator Hillary Clinton of New York, Evan Bayh of Indiana, were among those who addressed the DLC this week. But Senator Clinton voted no on CAFTA. So did Max Baucus, Senator Bayh, Senator Conrad, Senator Dorgan, Senator Johnson, Senator Kerry, Cole, Landrieu, and Stabenow. They all voted against CAFTA. This has got the Republicans flipped out. So basically what you're going to be hearing here, and congratulations, by the way, to Debbie Stabenow in Michigan, to John Kerry in Massachusetts, to Kent Johnson in South Dakota, Dorgan, North Dakota, Senator Clinton in New York, Kent Conrad, Evan Bayh in Indiana. All of the, you know, congratulations for voting against CAFTA. I think it's a shame that you're on board with the DLC, and I think you should get away from that organization as fast as you can, but at least congratulations for voting against CAFTA. And but the so-called hypocrisy, that's the talking, the Republican talking point of the day. Just so you know, I thought you'd want to know. And we'll see how this thing with the actual vote shakes out. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Matt in Kansas on the line. Hey, Matt, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Tom. I'm sure that there's just tons of people in Central America now that are lined up to buy Corvettes, huh?
Yeah, there you go. I mean, the few Corvettes that we're still making here. I mean, I'm wondering how much of a Corvette is still made here now that GM is making engines in China.
It's amazing. I did call Congressman Moore's office from Kansas, and of course it doesn't do any good to rip on a staffer, but they did offer to send me a written explanation of why he voted in support of it, and I'll make sure I share that with you when I get it.
Great, yeah, and you know, be sure and give me your name and address and all that stuff, and let them know, you know, hey, enough of this stuff. We want, if I elected you as a Democrat, please behave like one, and if you can't, we're going to find somebody else who can. I mean,
that was pretty much what I said, Tom, and I'm sure they will mail me something, and I'll share it with you when I get it.
Good on you, Matt. You called the 1-877-SOB-USOB number?
You bet I did.
Yeah, that's great. One of the folks in our chat room, by the way, misdialed it. They dialed 1-866-SOB-USOB. It's a Marine recruiting office.
They said it was almost as much fun. I've got 877-SOB-USOB on speed dial.
There you go.
They hear from me a lot.
Good on you. Good on you, Matt. Okay.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Derek in Woodbridge, Virginia on the line. Hey, Derek, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I gave a call to Congressman Moran in Virginia. And basically their staffer said that the person who handles that is not in right now.
Yeah,
I asked when that person would be in, and she did not know.
Congressman Moran, by the way, won the last election with 60% of the vote. So I'm guessing that he's sitting around thinking, no problem. I can screw the people. I got a good margin of victory here. I think it's really important to let these guys, you know, Moran, Tanner had a 74% of the vote, Cooper 69% of the vote. Most of them are in safe places. The only one who's marginally safe is Melissa Bean. All the rest of them are really in solid seats. And so they really could do the people's business. Or maybe they're simply using the fact that they're in a very safe seat to grease their palms as much as they can with the money from the multinational corporations.
Very possibly. But I have a idea for you, Tom. I don't know if you'd want to do this on your radio show, but perhaps you could give them a call on the air. And we could hear their explanation on the air.
I would love to do that. I really would love to do that. But the new FCC rules that went into place about 7 or 8 years ago say that you have to notify somebody, and this is the result of the shock jocks calling people up and doing goofy stuff, you know, with them, that you have to notify somebody that they are on the air and get their permission before even a single word of theirs goes on the air. And so I can't call up and have them even answer the phone and say hello. I'd be in violation of the law if I did that. And so what we have to do is we have to call them up and say, would you be willing to come on the air and do an interview? And 100% of the time, when they realize that it's not going to be a fluff piece, they say no. They say they'd rather go on the Chris Matthews show where they know that they're going to get softball questions and it's going to be a love fest, or that kind of thing. But they're not willing to go on a radio program where they're going to be asked hard questions, unfortunately. But
very unfortunate.
Yeah, I agree, because I would love to be able to just kind of call some of these folks out of the blue and just have at it. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Randy in Oregon on the line. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Our Senator Wyden, you know, could have stopped this thing, I understand, in committee, and then he went on to vote for it.
Yes.
I was at a meeting with the state Democratic National Committee members, and I threw something out that I think everybody thought was a little radical, but I'll throw it out here to you also. You know, all I have is my vote, Tom. I don't have enough money to throw at a senator to influence him. And I told that to them. I said, all I can do is vote against him in the next election, and that would double, I think, the effect of my vote. To say that I'm not going to vote for him is one thing. To say I'm going to vote against him, regardless of his running, you know, who's running against him. So,
right.
You were saying earlier, if you can get a Democrat in the primaries to run against him, vote for another Democrat. I think that they take our vote for granted.
Yeah.
Especially to the left. If we're to the left, they got us.
And this is what happened. This is what happened in 2000. I mean, Bill Clinton started the DLC or helped start the DLC. His wife now is clearly a bigwig in it. Look at all the love fest with the DLC she had last week, Hillary. And as a result of this, Ralph Nader, to a large extent, was right in 2000 when he was talking about the Republicrats. You know, the Democrats and Republicans, you can't tell that much difference between them. And it's really not the old line Democrats and the Democratic Party. It's a small chunk of the Democratic Party, these DLC Democrats, and the folks like Ron Wyden, who generally, frankly, is a good guy. But, you know, on some of these issues, I mean, he's just saying to the people of Oregon, hey, you know, you guys take a leap. You know, I'm going to take my money from Nike, you know, who wants to make their shoes in El Salvador instead of in China because the shipping's cheaper, and, you know, or whatever. I mean, you know, I'm speculating about the reason. And you guys are toast. And now, I have to say, though, I would not vote for a Republican over them, although I may look at a Green candidate or something like that. But I think that the most important thing is that we field serious primary challenges against these people and keep it within the Democratic Party to the extent that it can be done. And I say that as somebody who's not a Democrat. I'm an independent. And I've voted for independents. I've even voted for Republican once. I voted for Jim Jeffords.
So, now, can I elaborate on that? Because
sure.
I would agree with you 100%. But what you're saying is, okay, worst comes to worst, I'm going to stick with this guy because he's a Democrat. And then you got to ask yourself, you know, what's a Democrat? And Wyden does have a good record. But you have to weight the record also. You know, does he vote on the Democratic side on the light issues? Here comes Kaft. He goes to the other side. And all I'm saying, as long as Democrats across the country are willing to accept those things, they will continue.
You're right.
If we were to vote for a Republican and elect a Republican in 4 or 6 years, depending on the election, we would stand a chance of bringing in a real Democrat.
Well, maybe. My concern, Randy, because once, you know, incumbency is awful hard to knock out. You know, once somebody's in, it's awful hard to get them out, number one. And number two, if enough Republicans get elected, and we're awful close to it right now, we may not have democracy in the United States 5-10 years down the road. And that's a very real concern.
I agree with all that.
And so I'm not willing to play with fire like that.
If we have to take a look to the future, I just don't think that we can get I guess the respect or you know, the consideration that we deserve if we're not willing to draw the line and say this is a line you cannot cross.
I agree with you, Randy, and I think the place to do it and the place to make that noise is by calling their offices, showing up for the meetings, showing up when they do town hall meetings, joining the caucus, joining the party, speaking out within the organization and absolutely giving them hell. Randy, thanks for your call and thanks for your comments and thanks for listening on KBBR there in Coos Bay. I appreciate it. Ken in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WTKG. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I had a hard time making this call. I hung up twice when I was making this call, and I don't want to offend anybody in the South that's a good liberal, but don't you get the feeling sometimes that somehow the Confederacy never left us, that they infiltrated the Republican Party and they're running the country now?
The other way around. The Republican Party, this was Nixon's Southern strategy. The Republican Party said, we're going to appeal to the Southern racist vote because the Democrats are leaving them behind with LBJ integrating the schools.
Yeah, I mean, the South runs the government. Name me somebody that is in power right now in this country that is from north of the Mason-Dixon line. You know, you got Tom DeLay, you got Frist, you got Bush, you got Jeb Bush. I mean, all these guys seem to, their interest is in the South. And when I hear the number of Democratic you know, senators or congressmen that voted for CAFTA, and a lot of them are from the South. I mean, you know, they're from California. They're from California, and I don't know what the ones from New York are thinking. But, you know, and the people that are really suffering from this are the union workers in the North. I live in Michigan. We're taking a beating in West Michigan because all of the manufacturers where there was a strong labor base are taking a beating.
Yeah.
You know, we're losing jobs left and right. The auto industry, furniture industry, all those that were...
A lot of that, you know, Ken, I just have to say, a lot of that North-South divide isn't so much a remnant of the Civil War as it is a remnant of Taft-Hartley. In 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act, which allowed individual states to opt out of the Wagner Act, to opt out of, you know, having unions in their state in, you know, in a big way. And the southern states jumped at that because the southern states have always been, historically in the United States, about slave labor. And it's just, you know, a new form of slave labor. And now that's spreading all across the country. That's the big problem. But, Ken, you make a great point. I appreciate your calling and making it. Thank you so much. By the way, Kareth tells me that Nolenberg from Michigan voted yes on CAFTA. I'm not sure if that's if he or she is a Republican or a Democrat. We'll have to find out a little more about that. Somebody from Grand Rapids had called with that bit of information. Please add Nolenberg to the list of folks who voted for CAFTA. My list is just the Democrats who voted for it. There were 27 Republicans who actually stood up and voted against it. And at least one of them, Charles Taylor of North Carolina, his vote didn't get counted. Go figure. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Joy, listening on KXRA, our newest affiliate in Monterey, Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Joy, welcome to the program.
I am finally actually calling from listening to the radio rather than the internet.
That's nice. Great. That's great.
It's wonderful. And we have two new progressive stations in the area in the same week.
There you go. Competition's a good thing.
It is a good thing. And I listen to you in the morning. And I
well,
can take my
you.
Radio out while I do my gardening.
Right here on the no boring zone.
Yeah.
So what's up, Joy?
Well, there were three different items. One, I did call my congresswoman, Anna M. Eshoo, and I told her about the disparity in the vote.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, it not being one was not counted. And they did say, well, even if that did happen, which they thought was unusual, because it's electronically supposed mm-hmm. to be counted, said it still wouldn't change the outcome.
Well, actually, there were two or three votes that were not counted.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we know. Charles Taylor told me, he didn't tell me, a member of his staff told me, that he had voted no and it wasn't counted. Joanne Davis of Virginia, their person will not tell me which way she was going to vote or what happened. They're just like, we don't know, we're trying to find out, blah, 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 but they wouldn't tell me anything. And if you do the math, it looks to me like there's three votes missing because it comes up to 432 votes rather than 435. So,
okay.
You know.
I asked my congressperson staff to look into it.
Yeah, good.
To make
good.
Sure, because she did vote against it. So,
yeah.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, and was wondering if you'd covered it, about the ocean warming is harming the wildlife.
Yeah.
About the lack of phytoplankton and zooplankton.
Oh, yeah, we've done a couple of programs on that during our Bioneers segments every week. Yes, absolutely. Serious problem.
Very
and,
serious.
You know, not to mention the possibility that the melting ice shelves off the coast of Greenland are going to shut down the Gulf Stream and throw all of Europe into an ice age. You know,
the North Atlantic Current. Yeah,
yeah
that
the,
engine
yeah.
that keeps everything going.
Yeah, I actually wrote in two of my books about that, in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight and in The Edison Gene, specifically about that. And there's a piece on the Internet that I wrote about that. If you go to TomHartman.com and click Articles on Democracy, that just lays out the whole thing if you ever want to share that info with somebody. So.
Okay, well, I was going to mention that. I figured you probably had covered it, but they hadn't covered it elsewhere. So, and there's one last real quick thing. I don't know if you saw that article in the American Conservative, which I don't normally read, but that President Dick Cheney has tasked STRATCOM to draw up a contingency plan to nuke Iran if there's
yes.
another 9/11
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, we reported on that last week. Yep, absolutely. Did a major rant on it. In fact, Joy, I'm sorry we're out of time, but you're right. It's mind-boggling that these guys are already planning a nuclear war. against Iran, regardless of who strikes the United States, if there's another 9/11 excuse. Amazing. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
To the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you for the second hour of our program, 7 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Our website, tomhartman.com. Drop in if you'd like. Click live chat if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Yaron Brook, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, in just a moment. First hour, Michelle in Long Beach, California, been patiently on the line. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Oh, I was listening to you, the conversations of you and the callers prior, that about our representatives and how they, in fact, reminded me of this letter I got from Dianne Feinstein on flag burning. She wrote, "Unfortunately, we'll have to disagree on this issue." And I thought
she's supporting a flag burning amendment.
Yes.
Yeah, Dianne Feinstein increasingly, it appears, has gone over to the dark side of the force. It's tragic.
Yeah, and I saw this a couple of years ago. You know, her thing is, she explains that it's a symbol of unity. Well, that's kind of a dichotomy there. I don't know. That's ironic that she says that it represents unity when it amazes me that people put something such as something that's physically material, it's not alive, with great importance to amend the Constitution, but yet our soldiers, you know, that are dying, has anyone ever thought about amending or putting some type of civil right in the Constitution for those military service people?
Yeah, and beyond that, the flag is not a symbol of unity. It's a symbol of a constitutionally limited democratic republic, which is by its nature an adversarial system.
Right.
The whole point of the United States government is checks and balances. That is one group fighting against another group and
right.
Hopefully keeping any group from ultimately dominating everybody. And so for Dianne Feinstein to say that the flag is a symbol of unity is nuts. I mean, it's not understanding the basic principles of American history and American democracy, and it's tragic. Thanks for the call, Joe. I appreciate it. Dr. Yaron Brook, great to have you back with us, Dr. Brook.
Good to be back.
And you have a piece that you recently published on, did you write? No, Daniel Hohlenberg wrote this.
Yeah, one of my writers.
Or Hulkberg. Yeah,
Hulkberg.
It's on, but it's on AynRand.org on your website there.
Yep.
And the headline is "The Right to Buy and Sell Organs is Included in the Right to Life."
Yep.
Tell us what you're talking about here.
Well, basically, I believe that if we have a right to our own bodies, if we have a right to do with our own bodies as we please, and as you know, we support a woman's right to an abortion. We support the right for somebody to commit suicide. And if you have a right to
and
your
you
body,
support the right to use illegal drugs, and you support the right to be a prostitute.
Absolutely.
Right.
As a consequence, I think that people have a right, if they think it appropriate, to donate their organs and get paid for it. I think particularly, compensation for organ donation after death would be something that would increase the number of organs available dramatically, would relieve a lot of the suffering of those waiting in line for organ transplants, many of whom will die because the organs won't be there. Many people don't think about donating the organs after their death, and a financial some financial assistance.
If it added to somebody's estate, you think that that would be a good thing? People would be more likely to check off the card. You know,
absolutely.
You may be right. Before we go any further on this, and I think it's going to get even deeper than that. But before we go any further on this, I have a question for you, just kind of a general one.
Sure.
The objectivist philosophy that Ayn Rand came up with in her book, the Atlas Shrugged, I guess is the primary one, but she also wrote a number of pamphlets about it, and informing the objectivist organization and the Ayn Rand Institute ultimately, has, through groups like the Cato Institute and others, has powerfully influenced conservative thinking in the United States. And I'm wondering, why is it that the conservatives pick up from you guys the idea that we really aren't a democracy, that we really are all about capitalism rather than democracy? And I think that I believe that you don't disagree with me when I say that, that that's your point of view. You're not in favor of democracy. You are in favor of capitalism. Is that right?
Well, yes, although, again, you know, we get into this every time. I disagree that we've had a profound influence on the conservatives, and this human organs would be an example of that.
That's my question. They would
be offended by this idea.
Yeah.
But let me address the question that you asked. Yes.
Well, actually, I didn't get to my question, but
let me just address this issue of democracy versus capitalism.
Sure.
Yes, we're definitely anti-democracy, as I think the Founding Fathers were. We don't believe the majority has a right to kill Socrates as they did in Athens. We believe in individual rights. We believe in that the sole purpose of government.
So you don't think a jury should be able to decide something if the majority of the people on a jury decide that somebody should be put to death? That should not happen?
Within the context of individual rights. Socrates was put to death because they didn't like what he said.
Socrates was put to death by a jury of 501 men.
That's right, and that was wrong because he didn't violate anybody's individual rights. He was talking to people.
Well, actually,
so
his talking to people led to the overthrow of Greece.
Well,
I mean, that's what he was convicted of.
That's not what he was convicted of.
Read I.F. Stone's book on it.
He was convicted of speaking against religion. He was convicted for much of what you do. He was convicted of speaking against the Greek gods. And I don't believe the majority has a right to violate your right and my right to free speech. So there are certain inalienable rights, individual rights, that the majority does not have a right to supersede. They don't have a right to take my property. They don't have a right to tell me what I can say and what I can't say. So I am for a constitutional republic, which is what this country is, where the government's primary or only function is the protection of individual rights. And that political system I call capitalism. That is the political system that's capitalism. That is the complete protection of property.
But capitalism is an economic system.
No, capitalism is a political system that protects individual rights. That's what capitalism is.
So what's the economic system that goes along with it?
Freedom. The economic system is completely free markets without government intervention, because all we want is government to take out of the economic system the ability of one party to use force against another party. As long as force is not used, as long as all that's involved are voluntary transactions, and the organ example is an example of this, as long as it's just voluntary, government has no role in the economic realm.
Yeah, okay. Well, back to, you know, and as you said, we've had this debate many times, and
yep,
we probably will in the future many times, and so we don't need to cover that ground right at this moment because I'm, you know. But I'm just curious, if not you, certainly Ayn Rand and her writings and Cato Institute and whatnot have had a tremendous influence on the modern conservative movement.
Well, they have to some extent.
And I'm wondering why they are so eager to pick up your and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and groups like this, who all conflate capitalism with governance. Why they're so eager to pick up the capitalism part of it, yet they are afraid of therefore, if you're going to have capitalism, you know, the logical next step is that prostitution should be legal, all drugs should be decriminalized, people should be able to sell their bodies, live or dead, you know, blah, 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 blah. Why are they so afraid of that?
Well, because they don't understand what capitalism means. Capitalism means freedom. And if you advocate for human freedom, if you advocate for the people have inalienable rights, then the consequence is that they should be allowed to commit suicide if they want to. They should be allowed to have an abortion. They should be allowed to use whatever drugs they want to use as long as they don't hurt other people. They're afraid of that. They don't understand the philosophical foundation that Ayn Rand laid for capitalism. And as a consequence, in my view, the conservatives will never bring capitalism to America. They are doomed to fail because fundamentally they accept the ethics, the philosophy that is more consistent with socialism. That is the philosophy that says that people's lives need to be controlled by the government, and the flag burning is a good example of that. They are against flag burning. So am I, but they want a constitutional amendment to prohibit flag burning because the conservatives advocate for a form of fascism, control over people.
I don't disagree with you. And I know you have your arguments with the liberals as well. Let's get back to the organ donations, okay? Because we've got short time here, and I know that you want to talk about this. And we actually have a caller who has personal experience with a kidney transplant. I want to get him on too. But if we sell organs, we're in a situation where people can sell their organs, and I can just decide, hey, I need some money. I can't afford to make my house payment this month. I think, I got two kidneys, and I only need one. Ultimately, don't the poor get screwed and the rich have, a system where they can, live much longer than everybody else?
Well, the rich get the ability to buy organs that other people might not have, but, there's nothing wrong with that in my view. The rich have made their money, they've earned their money, and therefore can use it in any way they want.
So there's some moral superiority associated with being rich?
Excuse me?
So there's some moral superiority associated with being rich?
No, absolutely not. Healthcare is not a right. Healthcare is one service, just like we buy different cars. Poor people buy, maybe they buy Fords, and rich people buy Mercedes-Benz. Poor people don't have a right to a Mercedes-Benz just because they're poor.
And poor people similarly should not have
the
right.
Same way.
Should not have a right to health care in your mind.
Absolutely.
Okay, Ken in Grand Rapids is on the line. He's had some experience with this, wants to weigh in on this conversation. Hey, Ken, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thanks, Tom. I had a kidney transplant. It would be 2 years, September 9th. And I was on dialysis for 2 years. And my first year in dialysis, they put me on a second waiting list, because the first waiting list was so long that the kidney transplant people decided that there weren't enough good kidneys to go around. And even some of the kidney donors, their families were fighting the donations because, you go through that grieving process, and the first thing first thing that happens is, doctors come in and start harvesting all the organs, and the family was upset, and they didn't want them to do that. So you were losing a lot of, organs that way.
Got it. So what's your point, Ken?
So they started putting a second list. I mean, it's hard enough to get a kidney as it is. And when I was on dialysis, there's enough people, a lot of people that were there, I'm sure couldn't afford to buy their own kidney. So you're condemning those people to death, years of dialysis. And for, him saying, well, if you got the money, why not be able to buy it? Well, is he paying for his dialysis and all the other treatments out of his own pocket, or is an insurance company paying for that?
Well, but they
so all of a sudden the insurance company's paying for that, but all of a sudden, well, I got $10,000 extra, so I'm going to buy a kidney and
But that's what Yaron Brook is advocating, is it not?
Well,
Dr. Brook, you're saying if Ken doesn't have the money for a kidney, screw him. Let him die.
Well, I mean, what happens today? He doesn't have the money for a kidney, so what happens is his insurance company covers it,
he has
to ask for charity, right? Then
right.
My money is taken from me and through the tax system or through contributions, he gets his kidney.
So why don't
so
we have a system where...
What I'm saying is the poor people who can't afford it would have to go through the same process they have to go today. That is, they'd have to ask for charity. Charities would exist that would buy kidneys for poor people. But think of the supply of kidneys. The number of kidneys made available would far exceed the amount of kidneys.
You really think that money is the solution to all problems?
Would reduce the price, not increase it.
Now people would be selling their kidneys before they die, not putting their names on a donor list, or maybe when the person dies, the family saying, well, we've got a buyer for that kidney.
But who would they
want.
Sell it to? They would sell it to places that then distributed the kidneys to those people who were willing to buy them.
Yeah, okay. Ken, you make a good point, Yaron Brook. Let's pick this up on the other side. I want to talk about this for just a couple of more minutes because I don't think we've really gotten into this. And there's a solution that I see that I'd like to bounce off you as well. It's 20 minutes after the hour. If you'd like to call in, our number 1-866-889-8894. We're talking with Dr. Yaron Brook, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
And welcome back. Well, you better hope there's nothing wrong with your eyes that you might need a transplant. We're talking with Dr. Yaron Brook, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the objectivists, the folks, well, okay, I'll stop characterizing them as the founding thinkers of conservatism, because really it goes back to Edmund Burke.
Yep.
But there are a lot of folks running around loose who call themselves conservatives who are quoting your stuff. Let's say that.
That is true.
In any case, Dr. Yaron Brook, why not simply flip the paradigm that we have right now? What we have right now is when I get my driver's license, for example, if I want to be an organ donor, I have to check a box and sign on the back that says, yes, I want to be an organ donor. Why not make it automatic so that if I don't want to be an organ donor, I have to check a box on the back and sign it and say, don't take my organs? Or if I had, for example, a communicable disease or something, you know, somebody had Hep C or AIDS or something, that they would have to mark that down so that their organs wouldn't be harvested. And just make it a socially acceptable thing. Why do we have to make it so that it's really something that's mostly available to really rich people and not so much available to everybody else?
Well, I think I think my system would make it available to everybody, but because I think supply would increase dramatically. But let me just say this. I think the reason is that when an action is taken on you, you need to permit it. That is, you need to actively, it's like, you know, the opt-out from emails. The assumption is not that it's okay to send you an email. You literally have to now say, yes, I want to get emails sent to me. So when an action is committed on you, you need to opt into that system, and I think it's appropriate to do that. I'd like to see more people opt into that system.
But the reality is that there are a lot of things, like, for example, stopping at red lights when you drive down the street, that we don't opt into. We simply agree to as part of the social contract. We all agree that, hey, if we don't want to die in traffic accidents, we've got to have some kind of a system that organizes that.
Sure.
We're going to use
sure.
stop signs and red lights.
Sure.
It's part of the social contract. If we don't want to die from lack of transplantable organs, you know, we'll all agree that when we die, our organs will be available. What's wrong with that?
I mean, I don't have a principled opposition to it. It's just not. I think what's going to happen is you're going to get a lot of people opting out of it because, you know, there's no incentive there for them to actually be part of it.
So you really think that money is the only thing that incentivizes people? That people are not incentivized by simply caring about the public good?
Oh, yeah. I don't think people act consistently. I think people act because they think something's right or something's wrong. But there's no question that money provides an additional incentive for people to do the right thing in this case.
Do you think that's the primary incentive?
No, I don't think it's. I don't think. I mean, I've checked off the box. I mean, and I'm not getting any financing. You know, nobody's paying me to donate my organs. But I think it's a good idea, and I've done it. So I don't think it's a prime incentive, but it clearly is an incentive. And again, you know, you would get people who would even do it while they were alive because they need the money.
Right, and that's,
I don't think it's a bad thing.
And you don't think that, and that's the next logical thing is, okay, so what if you've got somebody who really needs the money badly and they decide to give up their cornea, they decide to go blind, but at least they can pay the rent for another year, or they can put their kids through school.
Well, if that is the only option, luckily I don't think we live in a society in which that is your only option to, you know, go blind or not be able to eat. There are plenty of charitable institutions if you can't get welfare. There are plenty of charitable institutions that will feed you without having to require that you go blind. But if somebody decides that a piece of his liver or one of his kidneys is worth sending his kids to Harvard, let's say, then I think that's a decision that they need to be able to make. I believe in human freedom. I believe people should be able to make decisions.
Why not simply have free public education?
What's that?
Why not simply have free public education like Thomas Jefferson envisioned when he created the Free University of Virginia?
Well, because I think public education, you get what you pay for. That is, public education, there's a good reason why public education is so bad. It's because it's run by the government.
The University
of California. The post office is terrible. But there's no reason for somebody. There's no reason for somebody who doesn't use public education to pay for it. There's no reason to take for some people to educate other people.
I
mean, that's against theft.
I remember when the University of California system was free, and it was a marvelous school, one of the best in the country.
Well, and it still is, and it's still packed, and kids
and
go
it's still,
to California.
You know, largely supported. Well, it's a discussion that, you know, we'll go on and on. Yeah, we will. And Dr. Yaron Brook, thanks for being with us today. AynRand.org is website. I'm Tom Hartman, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Today you're working for the man.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, indeed. That's the world of the conservatives. The rich get rich, the rich get healthy, the rich get health care, the rich get organs, the poor get charity when they can find it. And the rich may decide, what's this charity stuff? We really don't need this. You know, why should we do this? Yeah. And I just find it very refreshing, frankly, when the folks at Ayn Rand are willing to come on this program and just tell the truth about where they stand. You will not hear this kind of stuff from Rick Santorum, even though he believes it. You won't hear it from Bill Frist, even though his family have become billionaires and paid $800 million in fines for criminal activity, ripping off you and me in the healthcare system. You won't hear him talking about this, even though they believe it. There is a very clear distinction between conservatives and progressives, or conservatives and liberals, whatever you want to call it, in this country. The conservatives are very much about aristocracy and wealth and concentrated power in the hands of inherited wealth and corporations, using corporations as a vehicle to concentrate wealth, and thinking that capitalism is actually a form of government when it is not. It is an economic system. And liberals, like George Washington, who said, I hope that I shall ever see America be a beacon of liberality in the world, and I shall ever, and I hope that I shall ever see America be more liberal, become ever more and more liberal. Liberals like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, all the way up to today, holding up the American ideal of creating a nation that's relatively egalitarian. Yes, liberalism is at some level a meritocracy. Here's the fundamental cleavage, the fundamental distinction. Sir Edmund Burke, historically, and this is setting aside the Ayn Rand folks. Sir Edmund Burke, back in the 1770s, the father of modern conservative thought. You know, the guy who said, it does me no harm if a man has such a servile profession as being a hairdresser or a candle maker, but it does society violence if such a person is allowed to participate in the governance of society. In other words, to vote. That's the traditional conservative. It's why John Adams called the average person the rabble. It's why the Federalists fought so hard to keep the Senate from being elected by the people, because they didn't trust the people. And that's why the Senate was not elected by the people in the United States for the first 100-some-odd years of this country. It wasn't until 1917 that we got direct election to the Senate. We actually started electing our senators. Up until that time, they were appointed in smoke-filled rooms in the states. Every state did it a different way. So in some states, it was the legislature that did it. In some states, it was the governor that did it. But it was never the people that did it. So the conservative worldview is you can't trust the people. It's dangerous. You don't trust the people. Leave it in a small number of hands. Have a governing aristocracy. Now, they use the language of small government as if to say they're not in favor of that small aristocracy. But really, think about it for a minute. There is the commons. There's the air, the water, the roads, the schools. There are all these things, the police departments, the fire departments, the hospitals, all these things that we use in common. If government doesn't play some role in them, who will? This was the big lie that was promulgated by the Harry and Louise ads during the Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton healthcare thing back in the early 90s. When Bill and Hillary Clinton were trying to provide health care for all Americans. And you see Harry and Louise on TV going, do you want a government bureaucrat making the decision about what doctor you can see? I sure don't. And everybody in America is going, yeah, I don't want a government bureaucrat making the decision for me. But what's the alternative? Having an insurance company bureaucrat make the decision for you. Now, you tell me, would you rather have an insurance company bureaucrat making the decision? An insurance company that's not answerable to you or me? An insurance company that basically can tell us to take a leap whenever we want? And if you don't think so, try dealing with an insurance company today. Yeah, they say that there's competition. Right. Or would you rather have a government bureaucrat doing it? A government bureaucrat who is answerable to we the people through elected representatives. Or if you have a problem, you can call your member of Congress and say, hey, I've got a problem with this, and something gets done. The reason the conservatives are on this rant about smaller government is because they want larger corporations. It's very simple. You're going to have one or the other. Somebody has to administer the commons. They just don't tell you the other half of the story. And it's just so important to get this, to understand this. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, I agree with you. That is very refreshing, the intellectual honesty that you make these guys, well, they'll actually come out and admit that they don't believe in democracy. Yeah. And it's very good that you bring them on and have this laboratory to expose this, because you're right, the Republicans will not admit that they actually have that same thinking. So I love that you do this, because these guys are at least honest enough to do it. And it does come down to words, defining words. And he said, they always try to use the semantics, republic, we're a republic, not a democracy. You know, we all know republic just means representative democracy. And they try to fool people with that. And then he said capitalism is equals freedom. Is that like saying anarchy is also can be defined as freedom, so you build a civilization on anarchy? I mean, these guys, you're right. They want to conflate the political with the economic, and this is where it has confused even liberals.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of good old George.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Remember that?
I know. It's just, and he talks about freedom is on the march, when he really means laissez-faire capitalism is on the march.
That's
but
right.
Most people think he's talking about we the people democracy, right?
No, and he's not. And Tom, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing that out. And in fact, some interesting events, by the way, lest we miss them. The Prime Minister of Iraq yesterday said, you guys get out of here as quickly as you can. And the folks who have been saying, Those peaceniks who are calling for a timetable for withdrawal are giving the enemy aid and comfort. I've Bill O'Reilly ranting about it, you know, that this is treasonous that anybody would say this. They're traitors. How dare somebody say it? Well, yesterday the administration came out and said that by the spring we're going to start pulling our troops out. They told them when they're going to do it. I guess they don't get it about their own language. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Xavier, what's up? And thanks for listening on KRXA.
I'm still on
KXRA.
The internet. I'm still on the internet.
KRXA. Oh, okay. Well, you got to tune in KRXA. It's 5 a.m. 540. What's up?
They don't make it up here. But anyways, I wanted to agree with you as far as the organ donation thing. I think that we shouldn't pressure poor people to, you know, decide to sell their kidney to pay the rent. I think that's wrong. But I have to part company with you on the opt-in versus opt-out argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, now bear with me here, because this might sound a little politically incorrect, but imagine if we had a system where a woman is unconscious, you could have sex with her, and she has to write on a document, I don't want this to happen, in order to get away from that. Doesn't that sound kind of onerous to you?
Yeah, it does, but we're not talking about sex, we're not talking about unconscious,
we're talking about
dead.
We're talking about possibly unconscious and looking dead and them rushing to take your organs. It's just something that they're doing to your body, and I think that whenever somebody doing something like that, removing your organs, that's a lot more onerous than having sex with you. So what about
a middle ground then, Xavier? What about saying if you're actually dead, not, you know, brain dead, but dead, then you know, you'd have to opt out not to have your organs taken. But if you're on life support, if there's any debate, if there's any, you know, whatever, then you know, they got to wait until you're dead.
Well, there are situations like that now currently in place, and I what I understand is there are situations where organs have been removed just because, you know, there's what you're supposed to do and then there's what actually happens. It's kind of
right.
A slippery slope argument.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, I'll give you that. And there are no easy or perfect solutions is the bottom line. And anybody who thinks there are, who says there are, is demagoguing the issue. Here's where I think the next step has to go. And that is, we are on the edge of being able to create new organs, to grow organs from scratch. It's called stem cell research.
Right.
And that's really where we should be paying our attention. But unfortunately, we got these maniacs in the White House, and they're not up for that. They're not going to talk about that. Xavier, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, what's up?
Tom, hi. You know, I got a statement that I would like to make to Dr. Yarrow Brook. If you're listening, and this is for everyone else, you know, I've been an organ donor since I've had a driver's license, and I think that's a good thing. But if it's going to come down to the highest bidder, and what Brooke is talking about, if my organs could go to the highest bidder, I will leave my body to the Humane Society to be made into pet food before he or any of his aristocrat buddies get so much as one cell. So stick that in your 14-carat pipe and smoke that.
Okay, KJ. That's interesting. You raise an interesting question, and that is that if Yarn Brook had his way, there would be blowback. There would be blowback. There actually might be fewer organs available because people don't want to be, you know, signing a card or whatever and knowing that Don Trump is going to be first in line. KJ, thanks for the call and thanks for the point. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WTKG. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, Tom, I was listening to what you said about the Senate, you know, and how the Republicans and Libertarians and Objectivists all don't trust the common people. But I guess the one fly in the ointment with that theory, it's not so much a theory because we progressives can see that's what the conservatives seem to think. On the other hand, how do you explain the fact that the South, you know, the Deep South, which has become so dependably Republican now, that a lot of those folks are, to some extent, rather poor and, dare I say it, uneducated, and yet they vote Republican. So how do the Republicans, if they don't trust these kind of folks, how is it that's kind of almost their base?
Because they're very, very, very competent liars. And it's not just the South, by the way. Thomas Franks wrote What's the Matter with Kansas? And you find this all over. I grew up in Michigan. You find it all over Michigan.
Oh, West Michigan. I know very well.
Yeah,
sure.
And you know, I was just there just a couple of weeks ago for my my nephew's wedding, and I did a remote from the radio station there, the Republicans are just very competent liars. That's not to say that the Democrats aren't competent liars either. On some issues, they certainly are as well. There's no shortage of lying in the political arena, tragically, the Republicans have for the last 60 or 70 years, as a survival skill, they've figured out that because their real agenda is so completely out of touch with mainstream America, they have to couch it in terms that make it relatively invisible, or they have to divert people away from talking about the real issues. I mean, the reality is that most people are concerned about having a decent paycheck, being able to put their kids through school, having health care, and having a retirement. I mean, when you get right down to it, and having vacation time, you know, some free time, the basic elements that Republican Teddy Roosevelt, identified when he called for a fair wage in the United States in 1912. And the Republicans are going to do everything they can to keep us from talking about those issues, because on all of those issues, their attitude is, screw the average person, we don't care about them. And that's why they talk about gay marriage, that's why they talk about flag-burning amendments, that's why they talk about commandments in the schools, that's why they talk about prayer in school, that's why they get, you know, guns and gun control, that's why they get all hysterical about these issues and pump them up to the point of national crises, when they're not. They're small issues. I mean, some of them are important issues, and they're very often just very largely symbolic issues. But that's why they do that, is because they know that on the issues that are really the 80% of the concern of the average person in the South or in Michigan or in Minnesota or in Kansas or whatever, the average working person, on the real issues that concern them, the Republicans are always going to lose, or the conservatives, let's say, because there's Democrats who are in that camp as well, and the DLC Democrats in particular, and they're always going to lose. So they've just become very competent liars and diverters.
But on the other hand, I certainly, you know, can see through that, because, for instance, I don't believe in abortion, I don't believe in gay marriage, but I know the real issue is economics, because we have to have a house to live in and food to eat, et cetera, and I can see through that. Don't we have to put some culpability on the voters for swallowing this?
No.
We don't?
No. And the reason why is because the average person increasingly in the United States doesn't have access to the information. It's amazing when the University of Minnesota, as I recall, I'm pretty sure it was the University of Minnesota, just did a study, and they found that people who watch The Daily Show, a Comedy Central program, have a better grasp of national and international issues, a more realistic understanding of what's actually in the news, than people who watch Fox News Channel, which is 24/7 supposed news. I mean, you know, that there are major enterprises out there funded with billions of dollars devoted to lying to us, to deceiving us, to confusing us. You've got that on the one hand. Plus, you've got the fact, plus you get the fact that Bill Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act and Ronald Reagan doing away with the Fairness Doctrine, and even more than the Fairness Doctrine, doing away with the public service requirements to keep a license for a radio station, you've got the situation where real news is no longer required if you're going to use the public airwaves. And as a consequence, people simply aren't getting real news. And I'm not willing to blame people because they don't have control. They can't go down to the local radio station and say, give me real news.
Well, I will give you this. I think Bill Maher is a much more reliable political commentator, and he's a comedian, than Bill O'Reilly is.
Right, and how much do you have to pay to get Bill Maher?
I can't afford him.
Yeah, I mean, he's not on basic cable, right?
He's, he's on premium.
Right, so it's you know, $40, $50, $60, $70 a month, depending on where you are in the United States, if you want to get, you know, 1 hour a week of something that might actually resemble news. And that's my point, is that I don't think that we can blame the average person for not being informed. I think Thomas Jefferson was absolutely right when he said that an informed electorate is absolutely necessary for democracy to function in a republic. And therefore, you have to have a strong, free public education system up through and including college, and you have to have absolutely free newspapers, and that means free of the influence of monopolies as well. And that's where we've really fallen down, is we've allowed our media to fall into the hands of monopolies, and it's been a very destructive thing.
I'll grant you that.
Okay, Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. I'm Tom Hartman. You're in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You're the lucky one, so I've been told. It's free as a wind blowing down the road. Loved by many, hated by none. I'd say you were lucky because I know what you've done. Not a care in the world, not a worry in sight. Everything's going to be all right, cause you're the lucky one.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. A telephone number, and Pam in Lakewood, Washington on the line. Hey, Pam, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your program and how valuable it is to me.
Well, thank you.
And it's also so hard to sit online and listen to people talking. By the time you get to your turn, you have 10 comments and questions instead of, you know, your original. But anyway,
I'm sorry, it's the nature of talk radio. You know,
yeah, I was thinking about those ads for Clinton's, when you mentioned those ads for Clinton's health care program.
Right, the Harry and Louise ads.
I wish I felt government was more responsive than, say, the insurance person you would be talking to about that. It's just, I mean, I'm still registered in Oregon, and Wyden voted yes on CAFTA, and here in Washington, where my husband is registered, Cantwell and Murray both voted yes on, you know, so anyway, the question that really was...
Well, that's why we need to hold them accountable.
Well, yeah, and you know, while I may call and say, okay, you know, I need a written explanation of this. I want you to be responsive to me about why you did that. They'll say, sure, I'll do that. But then it's like he still go. Well, you know what I mean.
If you showed up at the next Democratic Party meeting and stood up and raised hell about it, it would be heard.
Well, I put it to him about his timber connections once when he came over to Bend, and I'll tell you what, I got pretty much nothing but evasiveness, do you know what I mean? And
sure.
yet he is very honest about other things. I mean, it just depends on what...
But
you just have to
keep at it, Pam. But is that what you called about?
No, sorry. I just got sidetracked.
Because we only have about 30 seconds left here.
It was about the Ayn Rand, gentleman from the Ayn Rand Institute.
Right.
Where does this so-called pure capitalism as political theory leave off and anarchy begin? Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's a very good question, and I don't have an answer to it. In fact, in my opinion, the pure capitalism that the Ayn Rand folks advocate and that Ayn Rand talked about in her book Atlas Shrugged is a form of anarchy. It's more of a Lord of the Flies kind of world, in my opinion. And you have to understand, Ayn Rand came to the United States in the Soviet Union. Her father lost his pharmacy, his shop, to the Bolsheviks in the Bolshevik Revolution. She studied political science at the University of Kiev and was taught that there was communism and capitalism, and that's all there was. And then she came over here with some very distorted views and basically no understanding of American history. And then you get a whole lot of folks following her teachings, and thus the neocons, among others. So, Pam, thanks for the call. Good to hear
from
you. I appreciate it. And it's a fascinating study, actually. There's a, if you go to our TomHartmann.com, to our message board, and find any message I wrote and click on the signature, you'll find some interesting information.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartmann here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, podcasting and archived at whiterosesociety.org, the live stream there, and also on Apple iTunes. Welcome back to our program. A couple of quick calls here. Rachel in Santa Fe from our last hour. Hey, Rachel, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Speaking of organ harvesting, I have a story. My sister went into a major West Coast hospital for elective surgery where she died on the surgery table, and this was a few months ago. They then proceeded to bill the family $450,000. We wanted to make a deal with them and say, you take her organs and cover the cost of the botched surgery and the cremation of the remains. And they refused the deal.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, Rachel. It's a messy system here. And like I said, there's no easy answers. Alan in Trumansburg, New York. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You're not on the air here, so I don't know if you've already been talking about this, but I'm really angry about CAFTA passing.
Yes,
I imagine you are too.
We spent the first hour of the program on it. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
How hard is it to back away from this if we get a Democratic Congress in 2006?
It could be done in one day. Just like George Bush walked away from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. We don't need no stinking treaties, he said. We could walk away from CAFTA. We could walk away from WTO. We can walk away from NAFTA. It can be done in one day if this government decides to do it. But I'm telling you, these guys are not going to decide to do it. They are too in bed with the multinational corporations who are benefiting from this. Speaking of multinational corporations and benefiting, Joseph Trento is with us, and he has done a brilliant job in his life of documenting the interrelationship of multinationals, power interests, wealth interests, inherited family wealth, and intelligence services. In fact, one of the finest books I think ever written on the CIA is The Secret History of the CIA, which Joe Trento, it seems to me like I read that thing 10, 15 years ago.
Well, no, that was it actually came out the week of 9/11.
Oh, okay.
But it may seem like that. So much has happened over the recent years.
Well, you must have.
Tom, thank you for your kind words. They're way too generous.
Yeah, well, you must have written something some time ago that I, you know, back in the 90s, that was when I first came to your name. Maybe it's maybe Lamar.
Probably Widows, my first book on the CIA.
Okay. It may well be. A friend of mine and I had done some. We were working on another book on another issue, but it was peripheral to the CIA, and we had done some considerable research on it and came across your writings. In any case, I was up, you know, I had 5 hours sleep last night because I was up half the night reading your book. I just couldn't put it down. And Joe Trento's new book, it's called Prelude to Terror, The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. And there are so many elements that you touch on in this book that I want to get into. that, and I'm just going to have to ask you to do it in short form because this is commercial radio. You know, we don't have the luxury of sitting around talking for an hour or so, but it's just amazing. The privatization of the CIA, going all the way back to World War II, the legacy of the Bush administration. In the very end of the book, you say, George Bush has a lifetime of friends and family have always come to his rescue, but sometimes friends fail on rare occasions. The safety net of family connections disappears altogether, as Bush learned when he heard the awful news on 9/11 in a Florida elementary school. At that moment, his personal history and the dark secret history his father and grandfather had helped shape all came together. Can you tell us what that means, and toss into that mix the piece in the book where you were at length quoting Gary Sick, but you also had a lot of your own information about the theft of the election from Jimmy Carter by Bush's father?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear now that we know that Bush's father and people working for Bush's father during the Jimmy Carter election had first supported the father who was running against Ronald Reagan in the primaries, as you may recall. And George H.W. Bush, the father, had inherited a level of history from his father, Prescott Bush, who actually was the most liberal of them, progressive of the three. And Prescott was involved with the CIA as part of congressional oversight and became very closely involved in CIA operations. And when young George H.W. Bush got out of the military and went into the oil business, Alan Dulles, who then was the guy kind of running the CIA, wasn't the director at that point, but he became the director, soon targeted Prescott's son for recruitment and successfully began to use him as an intelligence asset starting in the 1950s.
Yeah, I always thought it was interesting that George Herbert Walker Bush's oil company was Zapata Oil, and that the CIA code name for the Bay of Pigs was Operation Zapata, and the two ships that were used were the Barbara J. and the Houston.
Right, and George had a really interesting history with the agency, because he provided a cover, he provided recruitment during the Bay of Pigs and other help. But what he did that was really interesting was it was his job to work with the Mexican government in the huge infiltration operations we had going with them. And one of the guys he worked with was Diaz Serrano, who later went to jail for swindling the Mexican oil industry in Pemex. And his work with Diaz Serrano was among the most valuable he did for the CIA. So he had a real history of working agency operations.
Mm-hmm.
And when he became CIA director, he was already in love with the culture and became very vulnerable to it. Now, about the time he became director is when all these revelations were coming out by the Church Committee and others, and the CIA basically was in a very defensive situation. And it was under his tutelage that we began this bizarre relationship with Saudi Arabia, Saudi intelligence, where the Saudis formed this thing that Prince Turki called the Safari Club to basically pass money to the CIA for covert operations so they would not have to report on their activities to Congress.
Now, up until that time, Israel had been providing a lot of our intelligence. They had been sort of our covert ops partner in the Middle East. And from reading your book, I got the impression that George Herbert Walker Bush was of the opinion that the Saudis were more reliable intelligence partners than the Israelis.
Well, more reliable, and we had some more common interests, because that by that time, the Saudis were interested in spreading Wahhabism, and one of the ways they did that was start this operation to assist the Mujahideen against the Soviets.
Right. So the enemy of our enemy is our friend.
Right, and then once again, the U.S. didn't really look too carefully into who our friend really was.
Right.
And what we didn't understand was that the Wahhabists were already doing cross-border raids prior to the Soviet invasion. I mean, the Soviet invasion...
Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
Yes.
Yeah.
And out of fairness, this was totally encouraged by Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor, Brzezinski, who felt this was very important strategically and who actually made some hilariously naive offhand comments about the Mujahideen, saying how they're not a threat, they're not a problem, they're just minor figures. And as history has showed, that's a lesson that we all had to learn later, and unfortunately.
Yeah, well, for our listeners who don't know, the Mujahideen became Al-Qaeda and knocked down the towers on 9/11.
Yeah. Yeah. Not Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Right. Yeah. Which I can tell you, anybody who watches Comedy Central knows, but not most people who listen to Fox News know.
That's
tragically. So anyhow, as you were saying, so George Herbert Walker Bush Jr., as head of the CIA, makes this decision to shift our intelligence, away from gathering our own intelligence and away from a relationship with the Israelis into a relationship, a very, very deeply interpenetrated relationship with the Saudis, thinking that they're always going to be on our side, they're going to be helping us out, they're going to be our buddies. And the Saudis then start, and their friends, and there's a whole thing in your book about BCCI and how that came into being and, you know, helping to fund all these covert ops and whatnot. And then the Saudis started cultivating at the son of George Herbert Walker Bush, George W. Bush, George
right.
Walker
they,
Bush.
A few members of the of well-connected bankers to the royal family moved to Texas. They start working.
A member of the bin Laden family, in
right.
fact.
Yeah, Salim bin Laden, who was later killed in a light plane crash, and Khalid bin Mahfouz, who was the banker for the royal family, and who'd been accused of being involved in some terrorism financing activities.
But they bailed out Bush Jr.'s, first his Arbusto company, and then they bailed out Harkin?
Right, and they kept working with the family. But this is not unusual for the Saudis. They've helped a lot of other rich American politicians' sons either get rich, or stay above water.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just their MO. This is how they worked. And, of course, the big change is when Bandar was made ambassador to Washington in 83.
Prince Bandar, who just retired from that last month.
Right. Well, he's still officially ambassador. He's not in the country. But Bandar was running slush funds for the Saudis for all these activities and taking care of American politicians, keeping people happy, and doing intelligence operations. And those were all being done at Riggs Bank, which was a CIA front bank that had been arranged for Bandar to use.
Bandar, who the Bush family refers to as Bandar Bush.
Yeah, because he's so close to the family.
Right.
And now Prince Turki, who used to run Saudi intelligence and who was involved in setting up the Safari Club and who, by the way, promised us help with Al-Qaeda by having the Saudis keep tabs on Al-Qaeda, and which was one of the reasons George Bush wasn't too concerned about these warnings from his intelligence aides. He thought that everything was under control prior to 9/11 and basically ignored all the warnings. And that's one of the reasons. He relied on the Saudis.
That's one of the reasons why 9/11 happened, you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, we're talking with Joe Trento. Joe is the author of The Secret History of the CIA, a previous book. He's also the president of the Public Education Center in Washington, D.C. Is there a website for that, Joe?
Yeah, it's www.publicedcenter.org. And starting next month, they can go to a new website we're starting, www.storiesthatmatter.org, where we're going to post major new investigative stories on national security and the environment.
Marvelous. Joseph J. Trento and his new book from Carolyn Graf, titled Prelude to Terror, The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. We have about a minute before we have to take a break, and if you can stick around after the break, we'll have another 5 minutes to talk. Are you available for that?
I'm pleased to do it.
I want to go. Okay, so now we have George W. Bush beholden to the Saudi family, and he becomes president of the United States. Jimmy Carter's been trying to get Osama bin Laden. Not Jimmy Carter. Bill Clinton has been trying to get Osama bin Laden. Bill Clinton is very wary of the Saudis, although the CIA is still using them. And Bush decides to change our policy toward the Saudis, or affect it, let's say.
Yeah,
what happens?
Totally embracing the Saudis.
Yeah. And this change leads to a change in the way we deal with intelligence, which sets us up for 9/11. George W. Bush sets us up for 9/11?
I think what's fair to say is George W. Bush's ignorance set us up for 9/11.
Now, you don't mean ignorance as in stupidity. You mean ignorance as in not having information?
Not even understanding the intelligence community or what he was looking at or what he was being told.
Now, what about his advisors? I mean, he has some smart people working
for him. Well, I mean, if you understand who his advisors are, they're the same advisors his father used.
Like Dick Cheney?
You're right, and they all had their own interest, and one of the interests they had was to keep the Saudis happy. What they didn't tell the president was that the Saudis are a split family. The royal family is split between the Wahhabist and Prince Naif and others who believe in the kind of extremist Islamic behavior that resulted in 9/11. And those that don't, who are more westernized, like Turkey and Bandar.
Okay, we're going to have to pick it up when we come back from this break. We're talking with Joseph J. Trento, the new book, Prelude to Terror. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes past the hour.
generously exploring the truth of the day. Here's Tom Hartman.
What's wrong with this picture?
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, what's wrong with this picture? The Bush family taking money from the Bin Laden family, being in bed with the Saudis, and 9/11 coming up, and them telling the intelligence service, don't look into those Saudis. Don't look at that man behind the curtain. 9/11 happens, and then what happens, Joseph Trento?
Well, 9/11, even President Bush at some point wakes up and gets angry. He gets a visit from Crown Prince Abdullah. And doesn't like the way the visit goes, neither does Abdullah, because Bush, actually to his credit, asked some very serious questions during that visit. And Abdullah wasn't in the position of being used to answering hard questions. Abdullah then goes to visit the president's father in Houston, and the president's father gets his son under control. Ironically, while Abdullah's in Houston, a very worried Saudi intelligence asset in San Diego makes a visit to Abdullah's aide to explain that we have this little problem of money coming from the Saudi embassy in Washington, specifically Prince Bandar's wife's account, into the account of two of the hijackers.
Yeah, and that made the news for a day or so and then went away.
Right, and the reality of the administration's reaction to the Saudis in this situation was a public relations stance, telling the media the Saudis are our friends, Bush standing hand-in-hand with the Saudis, Bush defending the Saudis, saying all of these questions about Saudi involvement is basically media paranoia, and it became an open campaign to defend the Saudis.
Yeah.
That changed in Bush's attitude when he began to realize that his entire operation in Iraq was being jeopardized because of the Wahhabists coming in from Saudi Arabia as suicide bombers. And now that bloom has kind of gone off the rose. But what's ironic is the Saudis are very smart and strategically bright, and they've replaced Bandar with Turkey, and Turkey gave an interview the other day in which he said, listen, the problem in Iraq is that George Bush hasn't sent enough troops over to secure their border.
Well,
from our Wahhabis coming into Iraq.
The problem in Iraq is us.
Yes, the problem in Iraq's us, but not really. It's the Americans because they
right because they won't they won't stop us.
They won't stop us. And so
amazing.
The nightmare scenario is we've created with the help of the Saudis a state that was not pro-terrorist. It was a terrorist state in terms of where they treated their own people, but now we've turned it into an exporting pro-terrorist state intent on killing Americans everywhere.
That being Saudi Arabia?
No, that being Iraq.
That being Iraq, okay. But,
courtesy of our Saudi allies.
Right, but Saudi Arabia is still exporting Wahhabism aggressively.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're doing it with our money, by and large, the oil that we're buying from them. And yet Bush is doing nothing to diminish our dependence upon them or our addiction to our oil or our relationship with them, is it?
And the illusion also goes to Afghanistan, where President Karzai controls about 4 square blocks of Kabul and nothing else.
Right, they call him the mayor of Kabul in Afghanistan.
And the biggest problem is that the Pakistani intelligence service is still helping the Taliban, still assisting them, training them, and still protecting the bin Laden interests along the border and allowing bin Laden to travel back and forth to other terrorist states.
Yeah, now this is an absolutely remarkable book. You have to get this book. It's called Prelude to Terror, The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network by Joseph J. Trento. And it's really, I'd say, a very pro-CIA book in a way, you know, concerned about how our intelligence services have been damaged, in particular by 3 generations of the Bush family, if I may, you know, not to put words in your mouth, Joe. But also, I'd like to get in. We've got to take a break. Can you stick around for just another 5 minutes?
Sure.
And tell us about the October surprise at the end of the Carter administration, because that's something that, you know, got a little bit of publicity there. Barbara Honegger's book, Gary Sick's book, and then just fell off the radar screen. And I really think that Americans need to be revisiting this. What happened? Why did Bill Casey have part of his brain removed? You know, what's going on with this? Prelude to Terror, The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network, Joseph J. Trento. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 29 minutes past the hour.
bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's becoming more precarious for failing to toe the line in what I believe in. Sounds like freedom to me.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman with you. We're talking with Joe Trento. And normally, if we have an author on, it's you know 5 minutes. But this book is really really remarkable. It's Prelude to Terror: The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. Joseph J. Trento, also the author of The Secret History of the CIA, and Joseph Trento. None of this may have happened. 9/11, the whole thing, the Wahhabism, the exporting of Wahhabism. Perhaps the collapse of the Soviet Union, at least when it happened, is a result of their being bled by the Middle East and Afghanistan in a startlingly similar way to the way that we're being bled by them, by the way.
Bad coincidence.
It's kind of an ironic coincidence. None of that may have happened had Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush not become president and vice president in 1980. And that came about as a result of not a coincidence and not so much a failure on the part of the Carter administration, but a very specific plan that was organized by some people who may be familiar names to even young people listening, like James Baker. Tell us about that.
Well, what happened was the Reagan campaign made the decision to respond to offers from the Iranians, then the revolutionary government in power, to negotiation.
Now, let's just set this up for people who are not familiar with this, because there may be some people who were 10 years old in 1980. In 1980, the Shah fell. Carter had been reluctantly supporting the Shah. The Shah fell, and as a result of the Shah falling, the students, the revolutionaries, seized the American embassy and were holding the American 40-some-odd Americans in the embassy hostage. And this hostage crisis was bringing down the Carter presidency in the polls here domestically. Carter was being seen by people as being weak and incapable of stopping the hostage crisis. And Carter didn't realize that his own intelligence service that he was trying to use to get these guys out had been interpenetrated by partisans for the Bush-Reagan team.
Well, not only that, members of his own national security staff, who later became top officials in the Bush-Reagan administrations, basically betrayed Carter. During the campaign, they leaked copies of his foreign policy debate briefing book to the Republican campaign.
That Reagan then used in October of 1980?
To enormous effect in their only debate.
Right.
And made Carter look like a fool in the debate.
That was, what, October 26th, as I recall?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the end of it for Carter. But more importantly, all during the summer, the Iranians were not only negotiating with the Reagan campaign, they were trying to do the same thing with the Carter campaign through former CIA Director Richard Helms, who was kind of Carter's point man on all this.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we tell the story of how Helms actually allowed one guy in, a former school buddy of his from Iran, who actually carried a fatwa which led to an assassination conducted in the United States on behalf of the Iranian government, the new Iranian government. They killed one of the Shah's old press guys. The fact of the matter is, the Iranians were not afraid to try and negotiate politically, and they did. And in fact, in exchange for that, what we learned that's new is that the Republicans provided cash money for the mullahs in exchange for the negotiations. That was part of the deal.
So just to boil this down, the Republicans, the Reagan Bush, are running against Clinton, against Jimmy Carter and what was it, Walter Mondale?
Walter Mondale,
yeah.
That's right.
Carter and Mondale, and the hostages are being held in Iran, and the Iranians come to the Republicans, or vice versa. Actually, there's a kind of a meeting of the minds between the Republicans and the Iranians, and the Republicans and the Iranians say, we'll hang on to these hostages and cause Carter to fall apart in the polls, so you win the election.
They didn't do anything that specific. They were negotiating with both sides, just waiting to see who they got the better deal from.
Right, and the Republicans offered them a better deal.
Right, they threw cash in.
Yeah, okay, they threw cash in, and they also said, we will provide you with weapons, because, of course, the Shah's military was American-made, and now the Iranians were on the outside looking in. They couldn't get spare parts and things. They couldn't get missiles for their missile launchers. And so the Reagan campaign, not the administration, the Reagan campaign said, William Casey being apparently their point man, the guy who was doing a lot of this negotiation, William Casey, who was the chairman of the Reagan-Bush campaign, said, we'll give you money, we'll give you weapons, we'll give you missiles and all that kind of stuff if you'll hold on to the hostages until after the election.
And when and this was the precursor to Iran-Contra. They started working with the Iranians in 1980, not 1984 and 85 as we all thought. And what this meant was that they had a relationship with the Iranians from the very beginning. And actually, what's interesting about this is they were using Israel to sell the Iranians spare parts.
Now, couldn't you say that a presidential candidate, or a vice presidential candidate, in the case of George Herbert Walker Bush, working with his friend Bill Casey, to manipulate an American election by giving aid and comfort to an enemy of the United States, Iran, that was holding our hostages, purely for political purposes, is treason?
Well, it's worse than that. In fact, who he was working with was a guy named Ted Shackley, who is the deputy director of covert operations of the agency. And Shackley and several other business partners actually were using the agency in an enormous a scam called ITSCO to steal money out of the Camp David Accord funds for themselves. I mean, this became a huge scandal. Shackley has since died, but others of his partners are around. And one of the guys who was originally in on the deal, Ed Wilson, was in fact framed and sent to prison for 56 years by these guys in order to defuse blame onto Wilson.
Yeah, and then another thing, and I don't recall having seen this in your book. I read it in Barbara Honegger's book, but it may be in your book. I wasn't able to read every single word of the book, but it was that the guy who was engaged in these negotiations, Bill Casey, when Reagan Bush became president and vice president, they made Bill Casey the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Bill Casey got subpoenaed to testify for Iran-Contra. The morning, he was supposed to give testimony at 2 o'clock on the afternoon of a particular day. The date escapes me. 10 o'clock that morning in his office, he suddenly falls down with a seizure. He's whisked off to the hospital, and they remove his right temporal lobe, the right part of his brain near his ear, which is the part of the brain that controls speech. It was a surgical version of cutting somebody's tongue out, and he eventually died from that. Is that in your book, by the way?
It's not in my book. It's been reported before, but I have to say, I don't know if there's any connection.
You think that might just be a coincidence?
Yeah, I think he had cancer, and I think the doctors did what they had to do.
But it was the day he was supposed to testify.
That's right, a lucky coincidence for the administration.
Yeah, I mean, right there in CIA headquarters, the very day he was supposed to testify, and then his lawyer later said that had he testified, he would have blown the whistle on the thing. So, I find that. So, anyway, so here we have the president and the vice president, Reagan and Bush, they've become now the president and vice president by subterfuge, by this relationship with the Iranians and keeping the hostages. Jimmy Carter doesn't realize for almost a decade that he got screwed by these guys. But
yeah, he does finally figure it out.
Yeah, he now knows that. And Bush and Reagan committing treason to gain political power. And then they started pardoning people. There was this, Weinberger and all these guys were pardoned. Was that in part to cover up this stuff?
Well, I think so. I mean, Bush was doing it because of his role in Iraqgate and, the aid to Saddam Hussein, which they were all very nervous about. I mean, one of the stories we tell is the story of Sarkis Soganian, who is this Lebanese arms dealer who supplied Saddam on behalf of the Bush administration, Bush 1 administration. And Soganian, by the way, started talking to the media again just recently, and he was whisked away from a hospital. He's now 79 years old in Miami and taken to the Chrome Detention Center in Miami, where he has no exposure to reporters and has been there ever since and still remains there today because he was talking about Papa Bush's activities with Saddam. In fact, Papa Bush basically created the atmosphere for Saddam to wield power and later declared war on Saddam, but that earlier relationship where the United States and Donald Rumsfeld specifically built up Saddam is something that the Bush family really doesn't want told.
Even though there's photos out there of Don Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam and whatnot.
Right.
But they, well, they're burying that information as deeply as they can. Is that part of why Junior Bush Jr. has classified all the Bush Sr. records and libraries and things?
I think it's a mutual courtesy between father and son.
Yeah, okay. Now, I'm wondering, let me ask you just to speculate here. Joseph Trento, the author of Prelude to Terror, a new book, The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network, and the author also of The Secret History of the CIA, a brilliant, brilliant analysis of the last 50, 60 years of the Central Intelligence Agency and how it's been corrupted by a small number of people, in particular the Bush family, among others. Bush Jr. now finds himself in a domestic problem which has very little to do with Saudi Arabia, you know, surprise, with Karl Rove. And although there may be some larger connection there, do you think that given that his father pardoned criminals within his administration to cover up his own crimes, that now that we know that the memo that had Valerie Plame's identity first went to Air Force One the day after Joe Wilson's article was published. It went to from the State Department to Air Force One.
Yeah, it went to Colin Powell, right.
Right, and Colin Powell was on Air Force One. And I think it's above Colin Powell's pay grade to call up the assistant to the president and the assistant to the vice president and say, start dialing for dollars, out this guy to the press. The only guy on that airplane who I think had the authority to do that was George W. Bush himself. And, you know, assuming for a moment that it might be possible that George W. Bush himself could be at the core of this treason gate scandal or whatever it's going to be called, do you think that he's going to begin pardoning people the way his father did to prevent there being an investigation?
Well, you know, he's been very loyal to his staff. I mean, Stephen Hadley, who put the phony stuff about Iraq buying uranium into the president's speech, is now his national security advisor. And Condi Rice, who lied about many things regarding Iraq, you know, is now Secretary of State. So lying to the American public doesn't seem to stop people from getting ahead in this administration. But whether he'll fall on the sword for Karl Rove is a real interesting question, because obviously Karl Rove knows where all the political bodies are buried with Bush. And it may be a matter of mutual survival being the reason behind any kind of pardon. But I suspect that the prosecutor is going for much, much heavier grade material than Karl Rove in this case.
Yeah, and that might be George W. Bush?
It might be, but it might also be the vice president.
Oh, interesting.
Because the kind of behavior you're seeing, this kind of nasty kill the messenger in the case of Joe Wilson, is not atypical of the way Cheney does business.
So if that's the case, given the history that you know of these men and the Bush family and their close associates and affiliates like Dick Cheney, what's your guess of the future?
Well, it's interesting. Dick Cheney had a medical exam a couple weeks ago, and the first announcement we got was that he was terrific. And then the Judith Miller and Matt Cooper incident broke loose. Some new stuff came out on the case, and suddenly the doctor said, no, we found some problems. So I would not be at all surprised if Dick Cheney may resign from office before his term ends due to health reasons.
Ah, and that could be the end, and then a few pardons, and that's just the end of the whole thing, and it just goes away.
Yeah, I mean, that's generally the way.
Now that Jimmy Carter, okay, let me take it just back to this one thing. Now that Jimmy Carter knows that George Bush Sr. committed treason along with Bill Casey.
Well, those are your words.
That's my words, yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. In order to get Ronald Reagan elected president, that he conspired and in fact did interact with, cooperate with, pay off a foreign government to harm, you know, to do something.
Not foreign government. He just made a contribution to mullahs who are religious leaders who happen to be affiliated with foreign government.
Okay. An important distinction, I suppose, in a court of law. But
They do like their religion, these folks.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Now that Jimmy Carter knows this, now that you've published it, it's been a few years since Gary Sick and Barbara Honegger's books have been out. It's not so much a secret. It's certainly all over the Internet. Do you think that there's any possibility that there will ever be an investigation opened into the crimes of the Reagan and Bush administration or the Reagan and Bush campaign?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. I'm working on a new book on airline security. And in that book, we discovered that one of the biggest terrorists in history, the man responsible for the Beirut bombing, was in fact a CIA resource who was protected all during the 80s by the Reagan-Bush administration, the 90s by the CIA, and now again by the Bush 2 administration. So sometimes they can keep secrets for a long, long time. And had it not been for one of his Amal assistants informing me that he had given the orders to allow Hezbollah to blow up the Marine barracks, I would never know that the current number one guy in Lebanon is, in fact, a terrorist. We had negotiated with this guy. So these secrets tend to stay secret if there are reasons for it. And I suspect the kinds of things you're talking about have that same sort of currency. But eventually, thank God, everything does come out.
Now, you mentioned blowing up the Marine barracks in Lebanon. That was done, you know, on the Reagan's watch, and Reagan basically just kind of cut and run out of there to stay out of the way. Was that, we have a little less than a minute left, Joseph Trento, was that tied into all of this stuff, into the Bush family and the Bin Ladens?
Well, it's tied into Bin Laden because the guy who we had in prison in America for 18 years, a guy who could have told us the whole story, and the FBI and the CIA made sure he never was asked those questions. And he was actually sent back to Lebanon, where I interviewed him just a few weeks ago. His name is Fawz Yunus. And he told me the story of who gave him the orders to allow Hezbollah through to do these bombings, not just to the Marine barracks, but also the U.S. Embassy. And that guy is a long-term CIA asset.
Wow. Wow. And of course, George Herbert Walker Bush at one time was director of the CIA when this guy was an asset for the CIA?
No, afterwards. He was just vice president when he was an asset.
I see.
And in charge of all CIA policy.
I see. Okay.
Because Ronald Reagan could care less about the CIA.
Yeah, well, and from all we can tell, the last couple of years of his presidency, Ronald Reagan wasn't even home. You know, I mean, there was nobody there. Joseph J. Trento, the author of the book Prelude to Terror, The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. I recommend you check this book out immediately. Joseph Trento, thanks so much for being with us.
Tom, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Sometimes it's bad. When the going gets tough, yeah, we look in the mirror, yeah, we wanna give up. Sometimes you don't even want to try. Sometimes we cry.
Yeah, but don't give up, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. Get out there. Get involved. It's what we've got to do. By the way, did you see where Bombay now? All-time high rainfall. I've been to Bombay many times. It's a city. It's, you know, it's right there on the sea. And they're at risk of being washed out to sea. In the meantime, the United States, heat waves hitting records all across the country. And the cons want us to think, there's no such thing as global warming. Nothing to worry about. It's not real. It's just a bunch of alarmists. Somehow I think not. Somehow I think not. And then in the midst of this global warming crisis, frankly, that I think that we're seeing, the energy bill, which conceivably could have done something about this, Tom DeLay sneaks a $1.5 billion giveaway into it to the oil industry and Halliburton that will be administered by a private company out of Sugar Land, Texas, his hometown. What a surprise. As Congressman Henry Waxman says, the provision was inserted into the energy legislation after the conference was closed, so members of the conference committee had no opportunity to consider or reject this measure. Subtitle appears to steer the administration of 75% of the $1.5 billion fund to a private consortium located in the district of Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Could it be that he's getting ready for when he retires from the House and becomes a senior managing director of that consortium that now has $1.5 billion, and he's going to do like Poppy Bush did, and be, you know, become part of the Carlyle Group, or Dick Cheney did when he left the Ford administration and become part of Halliburton. In other words, join some company that gets most of its money from the government and become a multimillionaire that way. Could it be? Is it possible? Might he? Well, who knows? If he's not in jail, the guy's been, as I said, inhaling, I think, too much bug killer, and it's starting to show. We'll find out. We'll find out. By the way, check out, go to buzzflash.com. Right up at the very, very top, the little story in the upper left-hand corner. I ask you, is Bush giving us the finger? Literally, there's a videotape of it. Or is that his thumb? I think it's not his thumb. It's being debated in our chat room right now. You can get in on it. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Kareth for engineering our program, to Louise for producing it, to the folks in our chat room for showing up, folks at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org for streaming us around the planet and podcasting us, all of our affiliates for carrying the program, to our callers for calling in. Thanks to you for listening. And please be sure to patronize our sponsors. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.